Hi, welcome back to a new episode of Shut Your Face. Yes, I have kind of changed some things around, but it's still just as cool. Anyhow, if you're not a member of our Patreon, what are you doing? It's really cool. So head over there and become a member so you can get early access. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast, and let us begin.
So let's see here. We'll just jump on into this. You, sir, are... Can you just kind of introduce who you are and what you own and what exactly you're doing?
Yeah, so I have War Ponies and Lee Paint Cow Horses, which, you know, basically we breed paint, you know, APHA, Tobiano cow horses. So, you know, that's what, you know, what we do. And, you know, basically the other roles, you know, that I've played, you know, in the industry have just been as a result of trying to keep, you know, I guess, like the paint cow horse industry healthy and, you know, keep things going and other breeders going and,
you
know, keep everybody active.
Yeah, let me stop you for a second. You said Tobiano. Is there that's only the specific ones that you guys are concentrating on? Or not paint in general?
Right. So, you know, there's two types of paints. There's Overos and there's Tobianos. And, you know, we've owned both. And it just kind of, you know, when we got into the cow horse business, it seemed like, you know, Tobianos were what were more readily available and, you know, were actively being bred. What it is basically is that the Overos, they can be dual registered, a lot of them, right? Most of the Overos that are registered now with APHA are eligible for dual registration or are dual registered, right? At least in the paint cow horse world, most of the Overos are dual registered horses. And your Tobiano horses, they are not eligible for dual registration, right? So, you know, that's the difference, basically, is our horses generally are not. Now, that's not to say in the paint horse world that, you know, there aren't Overos that are just APHA registered only, because there are, but it just is a lot more predominant in the cow horse end of things. There aren't many Overo breeders, so basically, you know, most of those horses were either dual registered, whereas they were AQHA and APHA registered, or they were Tobianos, right? So that's
You're trying to breed your horses so they can't be registered AQHA. You want them to strictly be APHA.
Oh, we would love for them to be eligible to be registered AQHA, and I've actually, you know, advocated some for that, and there's been another large paint cow horse breeder that's advocated for that in the past with AQHA, but, you know, the horses that I breed, they're all predominantly strictly APHA. And that's not by, not by choice, it's because that they are Tobianos. And so the Tobianos, you know, when AQHA first started out, they, you know, said, well, you can't have any white on your horses above the, you know, above the knees and the hocks, and you can't have white on the face, you know, except for here. And that was the rule for, you know, the first 40 years or whatever it was in AQHA. And so all of the horses that were of the stock horse type, right, back then had to register with a different association, which they created the American, I think it was the Painted Stock Horse Association or Stock Paint Horse Association, something like that, which was basically just all the horses that couldn't be registered with AQHA because they had too much white, they were registered as paint horses, right? And then we've just seen in the past 25 years where that has changed, and AQHA has started taking those Overo horses back. And the reason the Overo horses have always existed in AQHA is because those genes can pass, I want to say, recessively. I don't know if that's the correct, like, DNA terminology or genetic terminology, but basically a horse can carry the gene but not express the color. So you could breed the same quarter horse line, you know, 10 times, and so the great-great-great-grandchild all of a sudden shows up with a white spot. And, you know, people are like, well, what is this? Did I, you know, did some stud jump the fence or what happened? You know, and then we found out over the years through science and DNA that, well, those Overo genes are, you know, recessive is the way I put it, which they don't, you know, the horse doesn't have to show it and it can carry the gene. So in AQHA, in the Quarter Horse Association, Overos have existed over the years. And then up until, you know, 2000 or 2001, whenever the rules changed, those horses had to then be registered as paint horses. Whereas the Tobianos, if a horse carries the Tobiano gene, it will have the color, okay? So it's never existed in AQHA because those horses would always have the color and you could see it. And so they were always ineligible to be registered as AQHA.
Gotcha. But I don't think the actual color determines the performance.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Right. Okay. Okay. I must be okay. Because when we learned all this kind of basic stuff years ago, but I thought that the whole purpose of war ponies was to keep paints amplified in the cow horse industry, not to migrate with quarter horse.
Right. And so the reason that is, you know, just to give you like a quick background of kind of what's happened, but, you know, the paints were very popular in cutting in cow horse in the early 2000s. And it seemed like by 2010, things just kind of disappeared, right? You know, mm-hmm. There were no paints. There were not many paint breeders breeding, you know, competitive cow horses and cutters. And, you know, when we came back into the industry and we started, you know, wanting to show and compete and do some things, you know, there had not been a paint Tobiano paint horse, you know, that had made the finals at a futurity since, you know, 2003 or 2004, you know, maybe 2005. I can't remember the exact, you know, there just weren't many competitive ones and there wasn't anything to buy to go show. And so it was very difficult to find the show horses because there weren't many breeders actively doing it. And there was kind of a problem in the industry. And I'll still say to this day, there's still a problem. You know, there aren't enough breeders doing what we do, and we're trying to get it to expand more and be more. And the way we get better genetics is by crossing with quarter horses, but we're trying to also have horses with that Tobiano gene that can be top competitors, top performance, as good as any top quarter horse, but express that Tobiano gene in their color pattern.
Yeah, because I think there's been an expression, I mean, not just within the cow horse industry, but in generalization of all paint horses, where some people were, you know, you have some people that really want to protect the actual things that make it a paint horse, that make it different. And then
Right. It's
gotten to where, you know, some things, I guess, get really slide in, like wouldn't be necessarily considered a paint, and they keep making the rules more lenient and lenient and lenient to make it bigger.
Right.
I know that that's kind of been a topic too, and it's hard to keep something preserved, I guess. You know, you want to keep white, and a paint horse is a paint horse preserved, regardless of the two colors. Has that been a challenge as far as just in general, the breed?
Yeah, I mean, the main challenge we had was just finding competitive horses and then, you know, and then breeding those and keeping the color, right? So there have been, over the past, you know, 20 years, there have been some breeders that were breeding really good, top-quality horses, but it was kind of one of the things, the color, they didn't focus as much on the color that it was important, so they would run into problems where, number one, you know, for the many, many years, and APHA is working on changing that, and I don't know if the way they're changing it is the best way, but the way they're working at, the solid horses were not very marketable, right, because you could only go show them at APHA shows, and they didn't express the color, so you didn't get the advantage of having a paint horse with the color, and then you had the disadvantage at the time of only being able to show at APHA. Well, APHA shows, at least for the past 25 years, have been really mainly focused at halter and pleasure, and so it's been mainly halter and pleasure horse as far as your local shows are concerned. You know, it was around 2001, 2002 that AQHA started their ranching and heritage program and the ranch versatility program, and, you know, AQHA was having a lack of cattle entries and ranch type entries, you know, in the late 90s at their local shows. So they started that versatility ranch horse program at AQHA and their ranch and heritage program, and it just blew up and became huge in all kinds of local competitions all across every state. And
well, APHA, because it makes sense.
Right. APHA did not do anything like that. And so what we kind of saw was is the quarter horses all got a lot better, and they had more places to compete and more competitions, and the paint horses had less and less, you know, as far as places to go compete. And show their horses. So that's kind of, that was before the specialization, right? So, you know, now we kind of have specialization where, you know, we have stock horse shows and reining horse shows and cow horse shows and cutting horse shows. And, you know, people don't do much as far as breed shows anymore, except for the versatility ranch programs. You know, but yeah, it was, I think that's one of the main reasons that the paint horses suffered over the paint cow horses, at least suffered over the last 25 years, is because there wasn't an active place to go compete and, you know, find the best horse and compete against each other and whatever else. And it just created a huge gap because, like I said, you know, 2000s, 90s, early 2000s, paint horses were in all the finals at all the futurities. Tobiano paint horses, you know, were in all the finals at all the futurities. They were very active, you know, and very healthy market. And when AQHA did that and really amped up the local show circuits for stock-type horses and ranch-type horses, AQHA just jumped leaps and bounds over where the paint horses were. And kind of when we came in, it was like, let's try to fix some of that and make it better. So we worked really hard with APHA, trying to come up with some different programs and different things to try to fix that, you know, and make it where the local paint horse breeder can, you know, make some competitive horses and have a market for them. So,
yeah, I think it says on AQHA's website, like, the first ranch class was in 2012, 2013, they introduced it.
Yeah.
So that's 10 years, little, yeah, I mean, that's pretty fast growing. Do you think it's grown because people can relate to it more versus your typical pleasure and rodeo environment? Why do you think people are moving so quick to cow horse in general?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's hard to say, and, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about this, but obviously it's a more natural, usable horse, right? So the ranch-type, stock-type horse goes back to what we all were supposed to be originally in the 60s and 50s when these associations started up, right? They were stock horses. Right. So they were supposed to be cow horses or ranch horses. And I think your regular backyard horse person or trail rider or local show person, they're all starting with a horse like that, right? It's just a basic ranch-type horse that could kind of do everything. And I think, you know, most of us who didn't start in the competitive, you know, horse show world started with horses like that. And, you know, I think what happened at AQHA and APHA over the years, obviously the pleasure and the halter horses got more competitive and specialized, and it kind of left the rest of the horses behind. And so, you know, I think that the ranching type programs, the ranch classes, they're just a more natural deal that you could kind of go in with a backyard horse that can do all the right stuff, and you could go in and not look out of place. You couldn't go in a pleasure horse, a pleasure class at AQHA or APHA horse show with a backyard horse with your trail riding saddle. I mean, you would probably be laughed out, or you would feel very uncomfortable, right? Like you were standing out like a sore thumb.
Yeah,
you
know, it has gotten a little bit out there.
At a ranch versatility or a stock horse show, you could go, as long as that horse can, you know, handles good and does all the things, I mean, you'll go in and, you know, you could place, right? So it's a big, it's a lot more beginner friendly and a lot more places for advancement, you know, in the ranch horse stuff than there is, like, say, in the regular horse show world, like halter and pleasure.
Right, right. And I got to correct myself. The versatility ranch horse events debuted in 2002. The world championship class at AQHA for the ranch debuted in 2013. That's what it just said. Yeah. I'm reading it right.
That's
the ranch pleasure debuted in 2012. So,
yeah.
But no, I agree with you. I mean, I grew up pleasure. It's almost like, you know, it can be very intimidating looking at some of those shows and stuff, and then the money, just the sheer money in the outfit is insane.
Yeah, and it makes it more complicated, and I think that's what's made, which, I mean, there, as you're seeing now, there's a lot of crossover coming back. There's a lot that have been competitive in pleasure that are crossing back into the ranch events just because they like it more. So I think it's got a double appeal. I think the appeal of being more beginner-friendly, and then, you know, also I think the more room for advancement, you know, I think both of those things are there that make it attractive to both sides of the industry, the more competitive, you know, horse show, pleasure-type crew, and the more beginner people. I think it's attractive to both of them.
Well, and we, not to divulge off of this a little bit, but we touched on this in our preface call. You know, specifically the paint horse within the cow horse industry is really small, and that's one of the reasons why you guys are doing what you're doing, correct? With that being said, I know we talked about some of the challenges with the big guys, because it seems like the horse industry can get like that. You've got either the big guys, or then you have the little people. There's like nothing in between, you know, and it's really hard to make that jump or to make that uphill climb to get to the top. What has been, as far as a marketing standpoint, to kind of let people know, like, hey, paint horses in the cow world is just as good? You know, what are you doing, or what would you like to people to know that makes these horses just as good as the rest, as the rest of the other ones? Because we talked about it earlier, you really don't see a lot of paint horses doing cow work stuff. You don't.
Right. So what I've tried to do, you know, is just promote, you know, so, and, you know, it does get noticed and it does get seen, and, you know, social media promotions, that's probably the number one thing, And, you know, obviously there are other breeders throughout the paint horse world that are better at me than it, but, you know, we've just tried to really, really promote and then create a atmosphere within the other breeders and the other people that are into paint cow horses at just like promoting each other, you know? Mm-hmm. So don't be so like, oh, this industry's controlled by this person or that person. And, you know, we're not happy for anybody other than those people and, you know, whatever, which is, you know, kind of the way it was when we got into it. And we tried to just get it a lot more inclusive and, like, really supporting everybody. Everybody supporting everybody, you know, because we needed all the help we could get. We didn't need the infighting anymore, and we didn't need the, I don't know, politics or whatever way you want to put it that was in it before. We needed to open this thing up, be real supportive of everybody, and really try to put a spotlight on every time somebody goes out and wins on a paint horse, we need to make it a big deal online. And, you know, we did it to that aspect that I've listened to other podcasts on people, you know, in AQHA and in Appaloosa, and they talk about, man, those paint horse people, you know, every time a paint horse goes wins a local show, you know, a weekend show, it's all over Facebook everywhere. Well, you know, I mean, that is kind of by design. Like, so we really did put a lot of effort into, you know, supporting each other and getting it out on social media. So the more people can see that, hey, paint horses are competitive, paint horses are going and winning the money, you know, they are out there pulling checks, and, you know, we want the world to see it, right? And then the more we do it, the more it starts to change people's mentality of, you know, hey, paint horses aren't competitive. Well, now they're seeing it in their face on social media for years on end, you know, and they start seeing it at their local horse shows or at major events. It does change their mentality, you know, from when we started in the paint cow horse thing in 2017 or 18 to where we are now, it's a huge difference in the public perception of paint horses being competitive in, you know, cattle events or, you know, any kind of.
Well, yeah, that's like what I told you. I was like, you don't see a lot of paint horses doing the cow stuff. You just don't. You don't see them. And it's like, it almost makes you wonder. When I first ran across you guys, I was like, huh, okay. I mean, not to sound dumb, like, oh, well, God, a paint horse can't do it. Well, yeah, we know they can. Sure. It's just like what you said. If nobody gets out there and gets dirty and is like, okay, well, we're gonna promote this breed because we know this breed can do it, it gives the consumer, ultimately, the rider, the exhibitor, the person putting the money into it, another alternative than what they're used to. And that's always a good thing. It's always a good thing to have another option.
Yes, of course. You know, and the truth of the matter is, you know, our horses, I mean, the paint horses are always really attractive to everybody, you know, whether it's the beginner people or, you know, the people who have been in the industry forever, and they're like, man, I just really want one of those good paint horses. You know, I literally have trainers at least once a month. I'll have a good trainer that's like, man, I really want one of those good paint horses. And it's like, yeah, me too, you know. We're trying to make more and more of them so y'all can all have one because, you know, everybody wants something a little bit different, and the industry's been so dominated by quarter horses that, you know, there's a lot of people rooting for the underdog right now, you know.
Yeah.
And we're really getting it. You know, I feel the public perception has really started to change, and people have seen, you know, all the horses that have been at the major events, you know, the past 5 years competing. People have noticed them. People have seen them on social media, and, you know, people are realizing, hey, these horses can go compete, you know, and we're severely disadvantaged than a lot of these other horses, you know, whereas you cannot breed two Tobiano, you know, paint horses and either one of them have won over $100,000. You know, it just, it doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Whereas in the, you know, in the quarter horse world, well, you can find, you know, dozens of mares. I mean, I own some quarter horse mares, you know, that have won or produced over $100,000, and there's tons of studs that just produce millions. And so, you know, that's where we're at that huge disadvantage. Here we are 25 years later after paint horses have not been popular and all those breeding age horses don't exist anymore that have won all that money. So it's kind of like you're building, starting from scratch. You're finding all this stuff that's bred from that stuff 25 years ago and was competitive back then, and you're trying to find which ones are still competitive now today, now that over the past 25 years the industry has evolved and gotten so much more competitive. And you know, we've just picked, hey, these ones are pulling checks now at local horse shows or here or there, those are the ones we're going to try, and then we cross them and we just keep building on it, and we send them the training. We figure out what we've got. Hey, the ones that aren't good enough, we sell. The ones that are good enough, we keep them. We breed them to something better, and we keep trying to build on it to, you know, create something that is basically like what AQHA is today, you know?
Yeah. Now, you guys, you have four studs there.
Yeah, right now we have four that we own that we stand. So one of those is our first stud that we bought, which is Sting's Color, which is a leading homozygous Tobiano producing stud. So every baby he has, because he carries two copies of the Tobiano gene, every baby he has will be a Tobiano. So we don't have to worry about, will he produce color? He will. And so, and we just happened on him by accident. I just wanted a Color Me Smart son to go show, mm-hmm. and to maybe breed some paint horses to try to make something a little bit better. And I just happened upon him, and after I had made the deal to buy him, found out what a good producer he was, and that what was available right now, he was probably the best option. So that's kind of how we really got into things and really started promoting everything, was after we got that stud. And, you know,
they're like potato chips.
Yeah.
You can't
and
have
we bred
this
him
one.
A lot to try to, like, get more, you know, mm-hmm. color and get more Tobiano homozygous mm-hmm. mares bred by him that will go and then be bred to top quarter horse studs to try to produce even a better horse tomorrow. But, you know, that's kind of how we, you know, got started with that whole deal there was Sting. And then, you know, after that, we bought the Metallic Chrome horse, and we bought him as a yearling at a yearling sale. And he was, he still is, last I checked, the only Metallic Cat, Tobiano Metallic Cat son in the United States. There is one in Brazil that's a really nice-looking horse that they're breeding there. But as far as in the U.S., that's APHA-registered, Metallic Chrome is the only Metallic Cat Tobiano paint horse son. So we bought him, and you know, as a yearling, and had him trained, and you know, went down the road and showed him and promoted him. And then the third stud was Dual Delta Ray, which is a dual ray son that is a Tobiano paint horse. And you know, for the longest time, that horse was kind of lost, and you know, nobody was promoting him. Nobody was breeding him. And around 2019, we started doing Equistats, paint horse only Equistats reports. And we got with, you know, Quarter Horse News, Equistats, and started, we paid for them basically to rewrite, you know, a program where they could select out just APHA registered horses only, and find Equistat stats to show, hey, which paint horse is the top producer in cutting, in cow horse, in reining, et cetera. And as soon as we started doing those reports, this dual Delta Ray horse was popping up, and nobody knew where he was. You know, he wasn't standing. He wasn't being promoted. Nobody was breeding him. And then every year, you know, his stats would go up. And then, you know, before too long, he was like the top five producing, you know, paint horse in cutting. And nobody was breeding him. And then one day some girl, you know, showed up on a Facebook group, and she was promoting the stallion for the owner, and they were going to try to breed him. And shortly thereafter, you know, a friend of mine, Herman Sloan, who's also a paint cow horse breeder, he and I went in together and bought him and moved him to my facility and started standing him at stud. The last horse is Vincent Ray Van Gogh, which is a dual Smart Ray son, and he's another one that we bought as a yearling at the Western Bloodstock sale, and went on, and, you know, he's shown really well. He's performed really well at major events in NRCHA, and so we started standing him with frozen semen this year. So that makes four, so which is really too much, but in all honesty, you know, the studs are the easiest way to pass on genetics. So if we're trying to pass on the Tobiano gene along with a competitive cow horse or cutter, you know, the studs is the easiest way to do it. In all honesty, the mares is probably the best way to do it. But the easiest way to get those genetics out there and spread them around and have more paint horses in the future that are competitive and have the color is by the studs. So, you know, we've been active in our stallion station, in our stud promotion, you know, the past 5 years, I guess we've done it. We've been pretty active with it. Just, you know, keep the blood out there, you know, keep the promotions and spread the genetics as easily as possible.
And where did the name War Ponies come from?
And so the War Ponies name's kind of funny. You know, my girls all high school rodeoed and junior high school rodeoed, and there was a real competitive mare around here that was, you know, doing the pro rodeo circuit and had done the amateur, I don't know if you call it amateur, but tri-state rodeo circuit, that was like, you know, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, or whatever. And there was a real popular paint mare that had done that and college rodeoed. And we had seen the mare before. And when one of my daughters was stepping up to a more competitive horse and we were looking for, you know, obviously a paint horse that was somewhat local that we could get our hands on that would be, you know, a 1D barrel horse for them to, you know, rodeo on, that horse was available. Well, like most paint horse owners that only own one paint horse, they call them paint, you know? And there's tons of people like that, right? And, you know, old paint out there, and because it's their only paint horse. Well, but regardless, the other name that they had for this horse was War Pony because she was a paint and she would always show up. She was always good. She could always go to war, you know, on the rodeo circuit here or whatever. That's what they called her. Her nickname was either Paint or War Pony. And so coming to my place with, you know, 40 or 50 paints, she couldn't be called Paint. So we called her, you know, War Pony. And when we were looking for a catchy name and needing, you know, something as far as the farm name, that's one that just kind of came up and we're like, that's going to be catchy. People are going to notice it. It may not be the best name in the world, but it's going to get us noticed and it's going to get out there. And so that's how we came up with that name.
That's cool because I thought it would have a reference to the Indians because they
yeah.
I think it's called Sioux Nation. I thought that maybe that would have a reference to that because they actually used paint horses, and then they would paint them, actually, like war paint.
Right, put war paint on them. Yeah. And, you know, that's not how we came up with the name, but it definitely references back to that, and people notice it for that reason and for all kinds of others. So, you know, it makes it catchy, you know.
Well, that's good. So did you grow up riding or just your girls?
Oh, no, I grew up, and that's where my girls got it from. So, you know, I grew up in South Mississippi. So, you know, around here it's all just rodeo or horse show. And so you have the pleasure halter world and you have the rodeo world. And I didn't start competing until I was like maybe 16 or 17. It was later as a teenager. And then I bounced back and forth between the local horse show groups and the, you know, the rope and pins and the rodeo stuff. And, you know, I ended it back at the horse shows, mainly because, you know, I had kids at a young age and the rodeo stuff was too much drinking and, you know, all the other stuff that goes along with the rodeo world. And I was like, yeah, I need to settle down and whatever. So I focused more on the horse show end of it. And, gosh, I think it was like 98 or 99. I was a farrier and I would start colts at home and whatever else. Well, I got involved with the Foundation Quarter Horse Association. This was actually the World Foundation Quarter Horse Alliance was what it was called. And they had local horse shows here that were basically like stock horse shows are today. Or ranch horse shows are today. Because back then there weren't any stock horse groups or ranch horse groups. It was basically just like your foundation quarter horse shows and your local club shows and then your AQHA shows. So I got involved with them like 99 or 98 and started training a lot more towards reining and rein cow horse. But I think it was around 2001, like I had moved back to Mississippi. I moved off to Kentucky and trained at a place there, moved back to Mississippi, and, you know, there weren't many places to show, and there weren't many horses. It was all just colt starting, and I wasn't the greatest at that. And after 9/11, I hung it up, you know, basically, and quit training horses. And decided to go be a police officer. I wanted to go to the military, and my parents talked me out of that. I became a police officer. So, and then, you know, we always had horses, but we, after, you know, maybe 2002 or 2003, we quit competing at all. And basically for, you know, 10 to 15 years, we didn't compete, you know, in anything until 2017 or 16. Is when we really got back into it.
Gotcha. Well, that's cool. So it's all family oriented, and your wife rides too, right?
Right. And she's, you know, I would say she's kind of more like the breeding manager. I generally kind of make the decisions because Leanne is not the, she's not a pedigree person or like she's not analytical. She's an attorney by trade. That's her day job. But if she could do anything in the world as far as a job, it would be breed horses. Like, that's what she loves, the science end and more like the art of breeding horses. So when it comes to all the AI stuff, embryo transfers, you know, ultrasounds, running 30 mares through the stocks a day, you know, that's Leanne's thing. She's very good at it, and she loves doing that. And she trusts on me to make the matchups of what we're breeding what to. But as far as the reproductive work, that is her bread and butter. That's what she loves to do. And never would have thought she would love to do it, but once she learned it and she started doing it, She found a real passion for it. So she, you know, she jokes every day that as soon as she could retire from being an attorney, that's all she's going to do is breed horses all day.
Aww.
So, and she wants to retire early. So that's the scary thing. I'd be overrun with horses. I don't know if there's a market to sell that many that she could breed, but that's what she loves to do.
So where do you guys kind of see war ponies in the next year, 5 years, 10 years? What are kind of some goals that you have for the business?
So, you know, on the showing end, right, which is promoting the business, you know, my goal from day one was to have a horse in the open finals, right? And, you know, obviously you get into it and you realize, like, hey, I've got to lower my standards a little bit. But the end goal is to do that. So, you know, I'm going to have a horse in the open finals. May not win the futurity, but I'm going to have a horse in the open finals, you know, at some point in time. And that's like, that was the goal to start with. And that's the goal I'm going to, you know, and I've had to lower that standard. Like, hey, we're trying to win regional titles and we're trying to win, you know, national titles or world championships and whatever else. But, you know, that's the end goal. And, you know, business wise, you know, our focus has really turned to the homozygous mares, breeding homozygous, competitive homozygous Tobiano paint mares to top quarter horse stallions. And that way I'm guaranteed to get the color, and I'm breeding a competitive horse both ways. I have the strong top end of the pedigree to sell at Western Bloodstock, you know, sales. So, you know, our focus has really been business-wise to get more horses in the Western Bloodstock sales in the top sale programs. So those horses are going into more top competitive cutting and cow horse programs.
Gotcha. Well, I think you guys can do that. You're on the right track to do that.
Right. I mean, we're focused real heavy on it here, and I'm really working hard at, you know, the breeding game is so difficult because you have so many plans and you're planning on everything to work out, and, you know, sometimes God's plans just aren't our plans, right? It doesn't work out. And, you know, 1 year we may breed to 10 outside studs and we end up with, you know, 4 babies on the ground out of those, you know, by those outside studs. So, you know, it happens. It's difficult. We just got to keep chipping away at it, keep working at it. You know, with the numbers, you know, it's going to come. It's just, you know, I've got to get the numbers up there. We've got to just keep making competitive horses, and, you know, it'll happen.
Now, are you guys going to plan on selling any directly to – are you going to sell any directly to the consumer? I mean, if you guys have babies that you raise and train, they can come buy a horse from you, correct?
Right, right. That's what we do now mainly. Like, I'll sell one or two. Like, we put them in the Solo Select yearling sales. And we've run one through Western Bloodstock sales, which it did fairly well. But, you know, our goal, we'll always sell horses directly to the consumer. It just kind of, you know, somebody may show up and, you know, they're buying a baby, a weanling or a yearling, and you think they're going to a show home, and then, you know, 2 or 3 years later, they're not. You know, they never even got started or got sent to the right trainer or any legitimate trainer or whatever. Western Bloodstock's just kind of one of those deals. It's my goal, right, because, you know, where we are in the industry. But, you know, I feel like if those horses get in to those programs, you know, get bought by a Western Bloodstock buyer, all of those horses are getting started in programs, right? They're all going to trainers who are competent and experienced and whatever else. So, you know, I would like to, you know, get more of my horses going that direction because I feel like they're getting better hands. And not to say, you know, a lot of my clients are great. A lot of my clients have sent their horses to trainers. You know, I've even had other clients that have picked up some of the ones that didn't go to trainers and then sent them to trainers later in life and have success that way. So, you know, the story's not over, you know, until it's over, right? So, you know, the horses are still getting out there. They're getting shown. They're winning. I just want to get them. I want to make a better and better horse pedigree-wise, to where the right people, the top competitive breeders and the top competitive trainers and owners are wanting to buy them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what any breeder's ultimate goal is to have their bloodlines at the top, you know. I think
right.
That's anybody's ultimate goal, regardless of the actual breed, you know. But you have
yeah.
to love it. So besides the color and besides the performance aspect of paint horses in general, why? Why did you choose paint?
So, you know, it's kind of funny. We had a paint stud here that, you know, I had not trained a horse in probably 5 to 6 years for anybody. I had a trainer friend of mine in like 2009 or 2008, and we were real big in the real estate business around that time, and I don't know if you remember, but the economy took a big hit, the real estate industry took a big hit.
Oh, yeah,
and, you know,
I was
we went,
in it.
Yeah, we went broke. So we had a title company, and we were in real estate investments, and I was a realtor at that time. So we went broke, and I had a buddy of mine, a horse trainer, with me back in the day, and he had a paint stud that he was riding and trying to train and was having a real tough time with, and asked me if I'd ride it because I was 20 years younger than him, and, you know, see if you can get this thing rode and get something done with it. And the way it turned out, I didn't get much done with this thing. I mean, he was decent enough, but I still had a bunch of nice quarter horse mares out in the pasture from back, you know, when I showed back in the day of the foundation quarter horse mares, and they were all cowbred and stock horse and, you know, foundation bred quarter horses. And I had this paint stud that was bred fairly well on paper, but he was not real nice. And we had been out of the horse business, like I said, though, and we were broke, and I was riding this thing for, you know, for extra money. And long story short, but, you know, I couldn't make anything out of the horse really, and he ended up getting too deep in the horse and didn't have the money to pay me. So he gave the horse to me, and he was a homozygous paint stud that was bred fairly well. So being the typical, you know, backyard broke guy at the time, I turned him out there with all my good old show mares and let him breed them. And we became paint horse breeders, and they were all bred fairly well and all were out of mares that had won money or won titles and, you know, reserve world championships. I mean, they were out of decent mares.
Yeah, hold on. Whoa, hold on a second. So you just let him out in the pasture with them? You just did it old school?
Oh, yes, old school backyard breeder. I have been, like I said, out of the horse business for the most part, and we just bred these things. And so when we, you know, and you know, we got them, you know, started and whatever else, well, fast forward to, you know, 2015 or 16, when my girls, you know, started rodeoing and whatever else, it was like, well, these things are all bred pretty good. Let's send them off to trainers and see if we can't make, you know, cow horses out of these things, because, you know, that horse is bred nice and, you know, they're out of legit mares. Let's see if it doesn't work, right? So we sent them off to trainers. And within 6 months, we sold all those things. And, you know, we're starting over because
aww.
I wouldn't say it's 6 months, but, you know, it was probably a year and a half or 2 years that it took to get through that progression to realize these aren't good enough. They're not going to work. And we need to kind of start over from scratch. And we were already, at that time, already investing in the paint horses. You know, the girls and stuff were showing, you know, APHA, and we had, you know, paint, you know, barrel horses and whatever else. So, you know, we just stuck with the paint horse thing. I did not realize at the time it was going to be as difficult or as hard as it was, but I am kind of that type of guy where you throw challenges at me. I want to stick with it, and I want to kind of a win. I want to achieve something. I don't want to give it up.
Right.
Until I've, you know, I'm not one to just quit on something. I'm going to find a way to make it work. So I just stuck with it, and, you know, it's changed a lot since then. And like I said, we, you know, around 2019 is when we got, or 2018 is when we got Sting. And that was when it really changed, because now we had a stud that was a big producing stud, was related to a lot of big time horses. And
well, let me ask you this. So hold on, let me ask you this. What was wrong with the original stud that you had? I mean, what, like, I mean, because, you know, here's the thing, and maybe I'm wrong, but when it comes to stallions and producing and da-da-da-da, well, if you don't get them out there, nobody's going to be good enough if you don't actually take a chance on one that hasn't been shown. You have to actually perform with the horse to produce some type of history or something behind it to support it. So what was wrong with that one? I mean, why did you switch out of that?
I had rode it. Another trainer had rode it, and I had rode it for years, and we could never make much out of it. And then when all the babies came out and they were pretty much the same way, we realized, like, hey, this isn't going to work. We've got to back up and go somewhere else. And at that time, we weren't going to be paint horse breeders or anything. We were just looking for stuff to go show with the kids and go out. And, you know, the whole thing really started from just being non-pros wanting to go show. You know, by that time, I had not trained anything in, you know, 5 or 6 years. I hadn't received money in, like, 8 years. So it was like, hey, we're all going to go show as amateurs or non-pros and, you know, go have fun with the kids. And they were very limited horses that we could show that were competitive, that we could buy, you know. And the stuff that we had bred wasn't going to work. And then when we went to go buy stuff, we couldn't find stuff to buy, hardly. So, you know, that's when it really became like, hey, there's a problem here. You know, there's a demand. People want these horses, but there's no supply. And so, you know, it was basically like, hey, let's start being one of the suppliers, because there's a demand. There just needs to, you know, there's no supply. So let's work on that. And so that's where we came up with the business idea, or I did, and I forced it on everybody, and then they ended up loving it. But, you know, let's help the supply, because there is no supply. So, you know, obviously that's a good business deal, right? Of course, I got myself in way too deep. But, hey, we found the success that we wanted. We've got out there, and we're still chipping away at it, like all breeders and all competitors. You're going to have high years and low years, and, you know, things are going to work out sometimes, and then other times they're not. But I feel like we're definitely in the right direction. And what I see now, kind of with what we have going, did not exist in 2017. I mean, there were no breeders actively really getting after it, trying to breed competitive horses. There were a few, and they were breeding like one or two, but competitive, like trying to breed 5 or 10 or 20, there were no breeders doing that back then. All those guys had gone out of business or gotten out of it or died off or whatever happened, or sold out. You know, there was a big thing on the South Americans. They love paint horses, and they love cow horses and reiners. And so, you know, it was around the 2010s, the South Americans would buy up every good one they could get their hands on. So those horses would leave the country. Well, that leaves nothing for the paint cow horse breeders in this country to breed to. So, you know, there's been several different issues that have gone on over the years that have aided in that problem of there being a lack of supply.
Yes. You were a solution.
Yeah, it's trying to. And, I, you know, it's hard to not sell. Like, you know, at the fraternity last year, I had some Central Americans came, and they wanted to buy, you know, one of my very top horses. And it was very hard to turn down that money. But it was kind of like I'm going to stand on principle. I said I wouldn't do this. I said I'm going to try to make this better, and I'm shooting myself in the foot. And, you know, my trainer was very upset with me at the time, which was Lee Deacon. You know, he was not happy that I was turning this down, but it was like, so I was telling him, Lee, I'm like, you say this is the best one that I've, you know, got yet. If we sell him, there's nothing that, you're not breeding to him anymore. We're not making any more like it very easily. And if we are, it's 5 or 6 years down the road. You know, I think we need to hold on to him and continue to make this thing better, because the numbers is where it's at. Like, we've got to produce more and more good horses. You know, there's a lot of people out there breeding mediocre or not good horses at that. You know, in our industry, there aren't many people breeding good ones. And, you know, the more that go to South America and aren't bred here, you know, the bigger our problem gets. So I turned it down.
Yeah, and then you also
– with me.
Yeah, and then you also kind of have the aspect of, I've talked about this before, you know, a lot of people, there's almost a divide on the typical horse owner that you have. You have a horse owner who is very much business-minded when they purchase an animal, and they keep it business-minded. Mm-hmm. They look at the pedigree, they look at what they're getting it for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the numbers, and that's it. Whereas you have other business, you know, or horse owners that they're very much a pet. They're very much a part of their family. So, you know, regardless of the pedigree, regardless of, you know, some of them have really great pedigrees and they're still like family, and some don't. Are you opposed to selling one of your horses to somebody that has no desire to show it, or to just have a nice, just a horse that they like, regardless of the pedigree?
So it depends on the horse. So, you know, on my lower end, you know, babies, I have no problem. Like, I sell them into those types of situations, you know, from time to time. The higher end, you know, I struggle with those, right? Or let's say it's a reject or something like that, one that didn't work out. You know, we'll sell those to anybody. The higher end ones, the ones that we have high aspirations for, you know, I'm fairly picky about that they go into good show homes or good situations. And I just have to be. Right now, with the paint horse industry and what it's been, I have to be picky that they go in the right situation, that they go to the right home. When it comes down to it, you know, somebody writes a check, you know, and I've advertised a horse for this price, it's their horse. You know, I'm going to stand by my word.
Yeah.
But, you know, ideally, I try to aim my higher end, the ones that I really have a lot of faith that I think they'll make it. I think this is the next thing. You know, we try to really make sure those things go into the right programs.
Yeah, because that my questions is a very touchy question, because, you know, you've got, it's not an offense, actually. You know, it's more of a, it's compliment in the way that you look at it, because you ultimately want, it's not like you're saying you're not good enough to have my horse. What you're saying is you want this horse to perform at the best level it can to help the whole entire pedigree. That's ultimately what it is, which will increase its price, which will increase its value, you know, not price, but value. Because a lot of people, that's kind of going back to my whole entire point of my question, you've got two ends of the spectrum in the horse business. You have people that look at them like pets. They don't really care what you pay. They don't really care about any of that. And then you have other people that have to look at the horse as a tool, because the horse is a tool when it comes to the performance business aspect of it.
Right.
So, but I just know that's kind of a touchy, it's touchy because, you know, it's just different. It's not like other sports.
Yeah, it's a funny area. And look, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, especially with my group, you know, with the girls, you know, everything is a pet. I mean, they are attached to every one of them. So, you know, it gets really hard to sell them all, and I have to keep everybody in the business mind of things. But at the same time, you know, I'm one of those. I mean, I was a horse kid, you know.
Yeah.
I was attached to horses. I looked, you know, I tried to make a living working with horses because I loved them so much. So, you know, I've become easily attached to them as well. You know, I think the last one we had that died, which was, you know, mare that, you know, my daughter showed, I mean, I cried so bad you know, my youngest daughter had never seen me cry at that, like, you know, family members passing away or anything. She had never seen anything like that, and she was just so surprised. And it was like, you know, I can seem like a tough guy and, you know, so whatever, but, you know, I really do love these animals, and there's something special and mean a lot to me, you know. So I kind of get that deal, too, where, you know, some of them are like pets, and I can't ever see myself separating from them, and, yeah. But it is still a business, and there's a lot of numbers. There's a lot of mouths to feed. We got to make sure we're concentrating it the right way, so.
It's got to be touchy. Like, that's why I brought that up. It's got to be touchy because I will take this to the grave. Horses, even though it is a sport, it is not like other sports. It's just different. When you have another living, breathing thing involved in the industry, it's different.
Right. It really is.
And I think – go ahead.
It's just – I was just saying I agree with you 100%. It's very different than anything else, you know. I mean, it's a living – it's like a pet, you know, I mean, something that you really become attached to, and maybe even more so than, like, dogs or house pets, because horses are so fragile and they require so much care. You know, it's like this livestock animal that requires so much attention and care to stay alive, especially when we're talking about performance horses. You know, when you got, you know, some trail riding horse or something like that, I mean, they never kill themselves and they never hurt themselves. And they never colic, and they never die, but you're talking about a performance horse. They are the most fragile things, you know, in the world. And I think all that care just brings out that, I don't know, that maternal type instinct, right, where you want to care for them and take care of them and attach to them or whatever.
And then real quick, I wanted to ask you about this, too. What do you think about the Horse Protection Act that's coming around?
I was worried you were going to ask me about that because I've been seeing so much on TikTok and social media about it.
I just seen it in the past couple of weeks. Like, I remember it being brought up last year very, very vaguely, but I was under the assumption it was only going to be, like, gated. I thought it was only going to be gated horses, honestly, but then now it's everybody. It's everywhere.
Well, that's what I think I probably got the same as you. Like, I saw it a year ago or something on social media. It was all aimed at gated horses. They were saying it could be a problem, but they were also saying, like, hey, this will never go through. This will never really happen. And now here we are the past 2 weeks, you know, social media is alive with this, like, hey, this is a big problem. You know, I'm more of like a libertarian type guy. Like, I don't like government meddling in business or in anything. I definitely see the need for regulations on lots of things, right? I understand that comes from a good place, wanting to protect people and things. I just feel like, and not to like impose any kind of political anything, but I feel like the government is usually the worst in the world at picking winners and losers and at, you know, protecting things, right? You know, the government waged a war on drugs for, you know, 40 years, and it's done nothing but make drugs more and more prolific and more people dying of drug overdoses every day. You know, it's like whatever the government decides they're going to fix or, you know, try to protect us from gets worse. So, you know, I'm really concerned, but I have not read enough about it to really know, like, how bad could this be for our industry. And mainly the cost. I mean, that from what I've seen just on social media the past few weeks, it just seems like the added cost of, you know, the regulations and what that could mean, it would add the cost of horse shows, right? So your horse shows,
which is already expensive.
Right. And so, you know, we're already starving to death. I mean, the economy kind of, inflation's horrible. The economy kind of sucks. Maybe it's bouncing back, but inflation's so bad. I mean, all of us are struggling, and those of us in the horse show world, I mean, we're spending small fortunes every weekend to go out and, you know, have a good time, promote our horses. You add any extra cost to that that's related to government regulations, and it's pretty bad, you know. And that may not be intended, but it's a legitimate result. I mean, I work in – I have several other businesses that are heavily regulated, you know, one in the medical marijuana industry and one in firearms, that I'm involved in those industries, and they're heavily regulated, and those costs pass on to the consumer, right? Those those extra people we have to hire to make sure we're meeting the regulations, all the extra work, all that gets passed on to the consumer. So, you know, my fear with anything that they may be doing right now, even though it may not destroy our industry right now, just the added regulations put on horse shows and having to make sure we keep records and these different things will add to the cost of show secretaries and show staff, and that will just get passed on to the exhibitors and the owners. And that's what I'm scared of right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's going to make it even more difficult. It's already, I do a lot of awards and stuff like that, and it's already hectic in itself to put on an event, you know, then to add that, the other stuff on top of it. But I agree with what you're saying. You know, it's coming from a good spot. I get that. But like they say, more money, more problems, and the bigger the industry got because of Yellowstone.
All these problems.
Yes. What comes with good will always come with a little bit of bad. So, but I just wanted to kind of ask I wanted to see what your thoughts were on it, because I'm just like you. Like, it popped up last year, and then it, like, went away. And then now all of a sudden, it's everywhere. And you're like, okay, when did this start to become a big deal now, you know? But it is.
Right. And it just worries me for, like, different things, like, you know, I mean, spur marks on the side, all these different kind of things that a big deal can be made out of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, I'm an NRCHA judge. I was a show rep. Like, you know, I've been a show rep for NRCHA. You know, those things get brought up, you know, at shows, and I've never been really concerned about them in the past before. But now that all this talk of all the USDA stuff and all this stuff about the Horse Protection Act, I'm like, man, do we need to, like, write something down about this, that this person, you know, noticed this on this horse or whatever? Do we need to take pictures and document? I mean, it kind of scares me, you know, the oversight being a little too much, you know, and what are we going to have to do to, you know, not be in violation of any regulations, you know? It's too much, you know?
Yeah,